Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for January 20th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and in it, I'm thrilled to be able to share with you the interview that I conducted with Danny O'Brien of EFF on the subject of the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. I was inspired to contact him and see if he would be agreeable to coming onto the program to discuss this in more detail than I'd previously heard him talk about it on a recent episode of Floss Weekly. There, he was talking more about activism, the open rights group in the UK, another group in addition to the EFF, of which I'm a huge fan. And he was talking more incidentally about some of the trade agreements that precede ACTA and inform that larger trend of which it's a part. And so we're able to actually unpack ACTA a little bit, kind of frame it in that larger space. And I think ultimately, even though, as he says during the course of the interview, we walk this really kind of odd line as we get into some kind of policy geekery, some law geek, international law geekery, we walk this fine line between that pessimism and actually, I think, ultimately, maybe some cautious optimism and some hints that there may be some better outcomes than you might be inspired to think just by contemplating ACTA, kind of looking at the cold, hard facts of it. Because of the length of this interview, it runs just a little over 50 minutes. There is no new hacker word of the week and no listener feedback this week. Also, I was only able to get a hold of Danny on the phone. So while I was able to do some post-production to improve, to enliven the sound of his end of the call, just be forewarned that it is still a plain old telephone call. And there's only so much I'm going to be able to do with that. I think that the audio quality on Danny's end stands up quite well. So hopefully you'll agree with me. And regardless, hopefully you'll find this content as enjoyable to listen to as I did in producing it. I was listening to Floss Weekly some weeks back, episode 95. And while Jim Killock and Danny O'Brien were talking about the open rights group, Danny actually brought up the subject of ACTA and also one of its predecessors, the Korean-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. And this sparked my curiosity to get Danny, who's the International Outreach Coordinator at EFF and also has a considerable background as a technology journalist and activist, onto the program. Welcome, Danny.
Oh, well, it's good to be here. Thanks.
Now, you're not the only person who has mentioned Chorus FTA. Professor Geist, in his exhaustive coverage of the ACTA leaks, also has compared ACTA to the Korean-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. In what ways specifically is ACTA based on or inspired by this earlier agreement?
Well, I think they're part and parcel of the same movement. We've been tracking free trade agreements long before the Korean agreement. The South American agreements were something that caught our eye, and we've been sort of involved in, because the sort of department of the Electronic Frontier Foundation that I work on really emerged when we realized that a lot of the sort of agenda of rights holders in attempting to place some kind of control over the internet and some kind of regulation about what goes on there were becoming frustrated at getting this through the democratic process in the U.S. and elsewhere, and therefore were using other venues to get this regulation through. Because, you know, at first glance, when you look at most copyright and IP rules, they look like kind of business-to-business regulation. It's like, you should get a license to do this, you will be fined, or you have an injunction if you breach patents or something like that. And traditionally, that kind of business-to-business regulation has a lot of sources, right? It happens in treaties, it happens in trade agreements, it happens at WIPO, it happens in these places that don't get a lot of public oversight. What's changed now, of course, is that everybody on the internet is a content creator, and everybody on the internet is a potential infringer of copyright if you forward an email. And all of us are suddenly involved in either as the victims or the beneficiaries of that kind of regulation. And yet there is no insight into how that regulation is made by the public. It's usually kind of deals made in smoky back rooms by, you know, the music recording industry making a deal with the composers guild or something like that. So what we see with ACTA and what we saw with these free trade agreements is that there's suddenly clauses in all of these which refer to the internet and how the internet should be regulated. And most of those clauses would come as an absolute shock to anyone who has any kind of working knowledge or practices on the internet. And our job at the EFF, unfortunately, is to pour through these things and find out where these problems are and try and get to the people who have some influence in that process, or if necessary, try and bring the public to bear on them. So I guess this is a roundabout way of answering your question, but ultimately what's happened is that you see the same thing in like the raft of free trade agreements with Korea and South America and so forth, as you see in ACTA, because they are part and parcel of the same lobbying process. And that lobbying process comes from big companies who want to protect their intellectual property and have decided the best way of doing that is by placing regulations on everybody who uses the internet. And they have lots of vehicles to do that.
So the secrecy is part and parcel of that larger trend. Is that what you're suggesting? Despite the fact that in reading up and researching the Korean Free Trade Agreement, there were public protests in South Korea over this trade agreement.
Well, so here's the thing, deal with free trade agreements, is the content of them is generally secret until they've been negotiated, until the last thing has been signed. Now, that's not the case with all treaties and trade agreements. You know, when NAFTA was being organized, was being negotiated, and when various rounds of the WTO agreements were being negotiated. These were topics where everyone knew that there was a public interest involved, so therefore they were pretty open. In the case of free trade agreements, you know, it's usually about like how much beef you can import, or you know, whether you can put tariffs on the following industries. So it's not surprising that they tend to be a sort of negotiated within a small group of people. What's problematic is when there is something in there that is going to have an effect on millions of people and the public interest, and frankly, you know, how democratic societies will work in the future, because all of that stuff goes through the internet. They aren't opened up, and no one in that process sees any reason why they should be. I think that there's a stark contrast between what happens there and when you have a debate about sort of how a law is being passed in Congress or in Parliament or wherever. You know, something like three strikes, something like termination of internet users access on the basis of the accusations of the music industry. That's controversial, It takes a big fight to get that passed through your lawmaking body, whether it's New Zealand, whether it's France or the UK or the US. If you can slip that into a secret agreement that everyone signs and then agrees to put into their national law after they've signed it, then that's a lot easier to get through.
Clearly, and clearly then, even though, I mean, we've heard pushback from in Canada from Tony Clement saying that negotiations in ACTA would not trump a Canadian-made solution, but isn't that kind of disingenuous to say such a thing? Because if they do sign on to the agreement, then they're obligated to essentially stand up to those obligations.
Absolutely. And one of the things that makes this so complicated is that, you know, every country going into this, their negotiators will start as part of their negotiation that they want to minimize the amount of law that this agreement changes, because by doing so, they make things a lot easier. And, you know, that's what you want to negotiate when you go into an agreement. The thing you want to come out with is the minimum amount of stuff that obliges you to do anything and the maximum amount of stuff that obliges someone else to do. So all of these countries are going in with that aim in mind. But all of them are going to come out with something that is going to change the law. I mean, it's particularly disingenuous for the Canadians to say this, because Canada has been a target for a very long time by lobbyists to change their copyright law and their IP law. For instance, Canada doesn't have the same kind of criminalization of the distribution of DRM circumvention systems that the US has and now that Europe has. And a lot of people would like Canada to have that in their copyright bill. There's been two copyright bills that have been proposed in Canada recently that both include that language. And Canada has been criticized by the US government specifically on this issue. It's obvious to me that ACTA will be one of the many different vehicles that kind of language will be attempted to be forced through and imposed on Canada. I'd be very surprised if language like that wasn't attempted to be put into ACTA.
But doesn't that present a broader risk that it's not, if they're targeting Canada or they're targeting a few exceptional states that are negotiating in the agreement, everybody, I mean, it normalizes to everybody ultimately. It's not just...
Absolutely. And the other strange thing about ACTA, so one of the things that we know about the ACTA agreement is that ACTA was created as an alternative venue from... WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, because the perception was that WIPO wasn't as quickly responsive to the needs of right holders. Now, there's a very good reason for that, right, which is that, you know, EFF and the developing countries and other interests are represented at WIPO. WIPO is a UN organization with an obligation, not always fulfilled, to be pretty open and inclusive about how it makes these decisions. ACTA is, you know, a secret process between a bunch of countries. And let's remind everyone what ACTA stands for, which is the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, right? So this is aimed primarily at fake Rolexes and that kind of sort of physical counterfeit objects. Now, you'll note that in the list of countries negotiating ACTA, China's not in there, India isn't in there, like any of the places where you would traditionally imagine that an international trade in fraudulent goods, counterfeit goods, would come from. None of those countries are negotiating in these rounds. And that's because the aim is to create, like you say, a kind of normative idea of what countries should do, and then pretty much impose it on other countries by saying, you know, you really have to sign up to ACTA, otherwise we'll put pressure on you in other political ways. You know, honestly, I mean, we don't have, EFF doesn't have like a dog in the game about like how you regulate preventing fake Rolexes or, you know, fraudulent DVDs. I think that there are a lot of complicated issues in that. And I think, you know, it's probably a legitimate business issue for a lot of American and other companies. What we're worried about is the civil liberties effect of expanding the idea of counterfeit products to bits and bytes on the internet and imposing sort of border controls over how that data passes on the internet. Because the people in that room don't understand the effect that a very simple statement like ISPs will be responsible for the infringement that goes on their networks would have on how the whole of the internet works.
Is there an opportunity? I mean, I was very much struck when you were on that Floss Weekly episode that I mentioned, your characterization of South Korea, its economy, before the trade agreement and after. Is there an opportunity to leverage that as a teaching moment against these people to make them understand that you know, there's an upside? It's not all internet threat. It's not all of that, as Jamie Boyle calls it, the, you know, 2020 vision of the downside, but that they're cutting off innovation, that they're cutting off as much economic opportunity as they are, as you say, addressing some rightly complicated issues of genuine commercial piracy and counterfeiting.
Well, I think that would be great, but you know, often these things just end up being sort of propaganda versus propaganda. If you watch how the debate about piracy online plays out, is that what often happens in that situation is that the IFPI or the RAAA will put out statistics saying the music industry is losing X billion dollars due to online piracy. And it's very hard to sort of test those figures. And when you do, they're frequently incredibly soft and based on some very dodgy sort of criteria. But they still get reported. It's kind of hard in a policy way to sort of, you know, South Korea isn't falling apart economically because of that trade agreement and laws that have been passed that are kind of unconnected with that trade agreement, but very much in the spirit of what that kind of diplomatic pressure produces. However, you know, I can list to you. So here are some of the things that South Korea has to deal with now that no one else in the world, well, that we certainly don't have to deal with. You have to put your user ID number on any forum post that you make. Content, even a restaurant review, can be taken down for, I believe it's 30 days after a single complaint. There's no sort of comeback to that, as there is even in the very bad sort of DMCA takedown regime that we have in the US. What remains still the first regulatory three strike system in South Korea. The French system is not yet sort of ground into action. Now, all of these things add up to a really surprising view of what the future looks like, because South Korea is often presented as the future of the internet. They have better connectivity, they have more involvement of internet services into a lot of things. But I think the knock-on consequences of all of those regulations are often pretty subtle and affected by a lot of other things. Companies like Google don't offer the same services as they do here in South Korea because of their concerns about either privacy or liability. But we all know that for every regulation that criminalizes a certain behavior or stops it on the internet, there are ways around it. I'm sure that you are obliged to put your ID number on your South Korean forum comments. I'm sure there's a lively trade in like fake ID numbers, and I'm pretty sure that South Koreans don't solely post to official South Korean boards that provide this feature. I'm sure they have wikis too. And, you know, I'm sure they use systems elsewhere in the world. So you have that weird thing of criminalizing normal behavior, and at the same time as if anybody wants to do that for like nefarious purposes or even just get away from the regulation, they can do that pretty easily too. So I think that the it's hard to draw conclusions yet out of South Korea. What I'm expecting, and we wrote a little about this on sort of our 12 top trends that EFF wrote for what we're expecting in 2010, is that now there are places like South Korea and France who are imposing some of the things, the regulations that the copyright industry wants to put on the internet, like three strikes. We're going to see an incredible amount of studies funded by rights holders saying, hey, guess what? The music industry is suddenly really improved in France and South Korea, and it's doing really well now for external consumption. And then within those countries, there'll be, continue to be pressure to place even more regulation on the internet. Indeed, I actually saw this happen. Like, I'd written the piece for the EFF, and then I saw it happen in France, where it's being proposed that there should be a tax, an internet tax that would be redistributed to artists in a somewhat arbitrary way. You know, if you have a three strikes regime, why do you suddenly need to subsidize artists in these other ways? And the answer seems to be that, you know, there's never enough that the internet can't do for rights holders. There's always going to be more regulation that internet users will have to comply with to buoy up business models which no longer work.
It sounds to me, though, that there's still cause for, if not optimism, for maybe constraining our concern, moderating our concern, and that it doesn't sound like you think that the norms are really going to be changed too much by if something like ACTA goes forward, if they get both three strikes and a media levy, or there was a piece about, I think it was France considering a media levy on Google Ads, essentially. That,
right,
as you
right,
say,
that's, people, yes, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah,
yeah. The folks on the internet are still going to do the things that draw them into that network space. They'll find ways to route around it. And in the meantime, it sounds like maybe not as a hard and fast case, but as much as you say, they're able to drum up yet more reports that are a little soft when you push on them. People on the other side of the debate may be able to draw up similar studies supporting the other side. And you know, I mean, maybe it sounds a bit cynical to say things march on as pretty much as they have, but it doesn't sound like then what you're saying is that ACTA is kind of the sky falling.
Well, you know, I think my thoughts that I gave on sort of South Korea kind of reflect this, that I think there are always two ways of thinking about this among sort of technical people who understand the issues. And one is this sort of technological determinism, where you sort of go, well, hey, you know, we still have our strong cryptography and we still have our anonymizing network. So I'm kind of okay, right? That they'll bring in some three strike system and I'll just use systems that they can't monitor. And therefore, you know, I won't be wrongly accused. You know, that ultimately the internet will triumph no matter how crazy this regulation is. And I'm sympathetic to that point of view because all of this regulation sort of goes against how the internet works and there are often ways around it. But the collateral damage is pretty drastic. And we deal with the collateral damage every day here. So the collateral damage is sort of cultural or societal. For instance, you know, the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions, which criminalize not only using systems to sort of unlock DVDs so you can play them on your Linux system or you can back up your movies or whatever. They don't only criminalize that, but they criminalize the trade or the trafficking of those tools, which means basically there's a whole industry that does not exist in the United States for offering these services, even when it's perfectly legal for you to make backups or for you to exercise your fair use rights. So that just doesn't exist. You cannot exercise those rights. What I see in South Korea and other places is very similar to this, that, you know, it's hard to put your finger on exactly what has been lost here. But it is something that simply vanishes from the society. And just because a few technical people like you and I can still do those things, doesn't mean that they've been effectively denied to most people, and also that we no longer live in a society where those things are understood as being one of the things that you're free to do. The other knock-on effect is far more direct, right? Which is the, you know, how this affects individuals. And another part of the FF's job is that we get to answer the phone when somebody's content is taken down from YouTube for some arbitrary copyright reason, security researchers or lawyer or professors at universities are threatened with legal action for exposing security problems in basically our infrastructure, right? So these things have ramifications, and if you make something illegal, then sure, there are ways that you can get around that. But having a society declare that, like, some speech is illegal or some uses of the open internet are banned has a terrible effect on the society you live in. And it makes the next step easier for other people to impose and a much harder for you to defend.
I want to jump ahead a little bit in my list of questions then, since you bring up the role that EFF serves in terms of dealing with that collateral damage and dealing with people directly affected, as you say, and put the question to you, what can we do? What can we do as activists? What can we do in any capacity? Some of my listeners are staffers working on the Hill or in other countries working with their legislative bodies. What can anybody do to stop that sort of that, as Glenn Moody calls it, that ratcheting up of this sort of copyright right. maximalism?
Well, you know, we have a lot of people are surprisingly sympathetic to this position, and increasing numbers. I think that, you know, I've always felt that time is on our side, because the more you use the internet, the more you have sort of somewhat intuitive understanding of the things that could damage it. It was very hard to explain to people, stopping people from copying DVDs to their home computers would be a bad thing, until the iPod came along, and suddenly people realized that this was something that they did every day, and that it shouldn't be something that made them into a criminal. So to answer your question about what people can do, I think that bringing in these other voices is really important. If you're a staffer, right, sit down and, like, work out who else needs to be brought into the room. And, you know, it needn't be like the EFF. I mean, we're advocates for this position, but, you know, look at something, and if it's a bunch of rights holders making this kind of decision, bring in internet representatives, bring in, you know, ISOC, bring in Google, Microsoft, or Yahoo, or, you know, people who sort of benefit from the other side of this. Bring in ISPs into the room. The biggest problem with ACTA is that for a very long time, you know, there just wasn't anybody in the room who understood what the internet was. And, you know, that's slowly improving, and that's an important first step. I think public oversight is so much better than that. But that's a start, because at least that highlights that this is controversial. And that's always the first step in these fights, right? Because most of these decisions start by people going, well, nobody really cares about, you know, a few fiddling bits of regulation for a bit of stupid technology. And simply raising consciousness that this is not like a non-political topic. This is something people really care about, is an important first step. And for those of you who have, like, you know, the misfortune to not be Washington staffers, I think that's really important. I think that contacting your senator, and, you know, you don't have to really bog them down in the minutiae of policy. I think you just have to say, I really am concerned about this anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. And I know that sounds crazy, but you know, the biggest shift that we've had in the last few years over ACTA has been from this being something that there really wasn't any oversight at all on, either in the EU or the US or Canada, to something that people in DC know as a controversial topic. Like, if you read Michael Geist's posts, you'll know he recently did a really good roundup of all the politicians in all of these countries who have demanded some kind of oversight over ACTA. And all of those politicians have done so because people have contacted them and said, hey, you know, this is something that you need to pay attention to. And that kind of oversight really is like the first step to moderating this. I think in the pursuit of a quiet life, it's amazing what bureaucrats and politicians will be willing to drop. And the sort of issues that get you and I sort of het up, which are these sort of somewhat crunchy and techy tech issues, you know, a lot of the time politicians faced with that kind of controversy just go, well, why don't we just not do this? Why don't we just wait until this has been sorted out and there's an obviously popular position to take? Because, you know, it's not global warming. It isn't extra jobs or a global depression or something like this. This is something that politicians choose to take up or put down. And if it's obvious that it's a complicated and politically dangerous topic to get involved in, politicians are much more content to say, look, let's give this a little bit longer until the internet, it becomes clearer what the right thing to do is.
That makes sense in terms of, I want to say that sounds, your characterization of that delaying tactic sounds like what we've been able to do in terms of staving off the broadcast flag through the broadcast treaty at WIPO, that it was just every time it comes up, there's enough concern that nobody's willing to meet the necessary consensus to move forward on it. And as you say, that both it staves off having, you know, over-the-air DRM, God forbid, and also gives more people a chance to understand open systems firsthand and appreciate them, and more of a chance for activists to educate, for public consciousness to come up. So I have [S2] Right. [S1] To say, I think that makes a fair amount of sense. I think we've got, here in the U.S., I know we've got, I think, just three senators so far that I'm aware of that have written letters to the U.S. Trade Representative, and there's clearly opportunity for the rest of them, for their constituents to be burrs under their saddle. And I don't think we've even tapped into the other House of Congress as of yet to leverage that same effect. And right. Talking to some of my friends with experience on the Hill, I think you're right in terms of the politicians would rather kind of drag their feet and be conservative and cautious about something in the face of that kind of controversy than to act on their own anyway, kind of in a foolhardy sort of rushed fashion.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure on politicians. There's a lot of lobbying pressure on them to do these kind of things. But, you know, everything has its cost. And politicians are very good at making this kind of calculus decision where they go, well, okay, I'll include, you know, broadcast flag legislation, but, and I'm not saying they explicitly say this, but you know, this is the calculus you take, is like, well, you know, how much is this going to cost me in effort and, you know, public ire and sort of controversy? And I think the broadcast flag thing is a really good example, because partly because I know it so well, because I was sort of the domestic activist of, you know, at the EFF in the U.S. when this was going through. And we had close on 2 years of, like, somebody trying to put in broadcast flag clauses into every single freaking law that had anything to do with TV for 2 years. And it was crazy, because the process would go, we'd hear a rumor from a staffer that this stuff was going to go in on this date. We would get everybody to write in to the representatives or the senators who were on that committee to ask questions about this. Like, we'd point out the problems, we'd say, hey, you know, ask these questions, find out why this in this bill, what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And then given under the face of that kind of oversight, it would be quietly withdrawn. And it's frustrating from the point of view of sort of activists to be involved in that sort of thing, because it doesn't feel like you're making any headway, right? And sometimes it doesn't feel like you're doing anything at all, right? Because you'll write to your representative and say, hey, ask these questions, and then nothing happens, or at least it appears that nothing happens. Whereas behind the scenes, I could see that every time we did that, someone would go, oh, I don't think this is an appropriate moment to introduce this. It seems to be getting a lot of pushback. We'll do it at a later date. And so this happened repeatedly until it got to the point where HDTV, digital TV, was launched in the US, at which point it's going to be much harder to introduce DRM, a broadcast flag, into the infrastructure, because people have their digital TVs. And they don't support the broadcast flag. So what are you going to do? Like, make everyone buy new TVs again? And that's often the process that goes on. And I think that stuff like ACTA is an attempt to bypass that problem. And that's what makes it really dangerous and problematic. Because you know, I'm not able to, like, harangue the people in that room and say, hey, why don't you not include an internet chapter? Which is what I think that, personally, that's what makes complete sense to me as far as ACTA. ACTA is an anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. Drop the stuff about the internet. The internet has nothing to do with counterfeiting. And it's a stretch to claim that it is. So why don't you just drop that clause? But it's very hard to do that same kind of constant pressure to not do something in a group of people whose only reason to be in that room is to do something in that area.
I think you've given us some good rhetoric, some good ideas to think about in terms of, I like the way you put that, just it doesn't have to be crunchy and deeply technical, but if you're going to write your representatives, your elected representatives, with concern, it can be targeted more towards, as you say, not necessarily the things that really are more normative to these sorts of trade agreements, but, you know, why is a counterfeiting agreement speaking to the internet at all in any right. fashion? And the other cause for hope that I have, and, you know, maybe this is just some willful delusion on my part, is, you know, as effective as that delaying strategy is, and the rising pressure on the one side you talk about as people get more acclimated to the internet and to the kinds of technologies and innovations that it affords us, is on the flip side, is the longer that these lobbyists can keep pushing for these sorts of restrictions, isn't it at some point like pouring gasoline on a fire? I mean, Lord Lucas, in criticizing the digital economy bill, which is sort of a piece with this larger trend, said, you know, these problems of piracy, these problems that you guys are stating in terms of lost sales and lost customers, are really of your own making because you didn't respond. So as long as they're concentrating on not responding to where the norms are, where people want to spend their money, and they're in these smoky back rooms dealing with these very frustrating sorts of issues that we've been talking about, you know, isn't it possible that on a long enough trajectory, the world will just out evolve them and we'll be on to something else, and it won't matter anymore.
Well, you know, I'm sort of, you know, I don't see the for all my sort of talk of, like, you know, the rights holders and the entertainment industry, you know, I don't see these people as, you know, completely contra the internet as a group, right? I feel that they're in this struggle to try and adjust their business to come to terms with this new reality, and lobbying and regulation are, you know, one of the tools in the box of an established business to fix things in their business. But I think you're right. You know, I one of the things that's been so nice over the last of 10 years about in this situation where we constantly find ourselves sort of faced against the entertainment industry of all the industries, right? You know, it's the one devoted to just making people have a nice time that seems to be strongly arrayed against free speech and privacy online, right? But one of the things that's shifted is that 10 years ago, the people we were dealing with were people who were honestly going to retire before the internet was an important part in their business. You know, no matter how quickly things were changing, what was more important to them was preserving how things were, rather than anticipating what was to come in a generation. And now, you know, the music industry and the film business is often a young business, right? And the people who are now there, well, if they're young anyway, so they understand the internet, you know, they're not people for whom sharing music online is just something that evil criminals do. They probably grew up in an environment where that's how you shared the music that you loved. And also, they come into the music industry, or they come into the TV industry, or they come into the movie industry, despite the fact that there seemed to be this strong attack on the way things are done by new technology. They may well have come into those industries because they love that new technology and they want to use it. And of course, that makes things incredibly much more easy to deal with. Because there isn't a sort of instinctive opposition. And so I think that's my hope, right? My hope is that when you go into those smoky rooms where deals are made, that you don't have to deal with people who simply don't understand what they're dealing with, right? Simply don't understand that if they do X, then all kinds of damaging things will happen to W, Y, and Z, and they'll trim what they're trying to ask for to bear that in mind. And we're talking in sort of a fairly detailed kind of, you know, how do these things work kind of way. So I'll talk a bit more sort of, you know, deep baseball on this. That one of the more sort of dangerous things that has emerged in the last few years, I think, is the rhetoric changing from we have to stop these evil kid criminals from file sharing, or, you know, these terrible MIT students who, write software that will destroy our industry, blah, 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 to the situation where the rhetoric is much more about there is this other industry that is stealing our money. You know, the entertainment industry now says it's less targeted at you and I and more targeted at intermediaries, YouTube or internet service providers or any of these people. Now, I think that's sort of, that's disturbing to me because, for one thing, it suddenly makes it into another smoky room deal. And I don't personally trust those companies to necessarily do the right thing if they're the representatives of individuals in those smoky rooms. a lot of the companies that are now seen as internet giants emerged from, you know, a bunch of hackers or a bunch of geeks in a garage. And often their instincts are really in the right place, but they're not going to necessarily always represent those interests. And suddenly it becomes a sort of fight between them, the sort of new money, as it were, with the old money of the rights holders or whoever else has a bone to pick with the internet. And I worry sometimes that, you know, Comcast or Google or any of these companies is going to cut a deal in order to get these people off their backs, which also cuts out what individual users benefit from.
Well, there's the opportunity, as you suggested earlier, too, that there's no guaranteed outcome either way, but there's at least the opportunity if it is back to, you know, corp to corp, trying to negotiate these things, that, you know, rather than the public interest, which has very little lobbying power, you know, we have free speech and jurisdictions where we have that, where we can go to our representatives and express our concerns. But, you know, I see what you're saying, and I understand that there's definitely some concern there, but it's, again, that the sky isn't falling. It's just we have to, as engaged citizens, we have to keep kind of tracking where the risks are, be involved, even to petition our service providers when it makes sense in the scenario you were talking about, to say, or if there's opportunity, there's even there, you know, the market opportunity for us to vote with our feet, if it exists, to go to somebody else who maybe better serves those interests.
Right. And I think that, you know, there's so many different strategies. I mean, I think it's sort of interesting that we've ended up talking about like the political side of this when, and I'm not sure that everyone realizes this about the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is that we're actually, the stuff we do is far more concentrated in kind of what's called public impact litigation, which is to say the sort of thing the ACLU does, where we're not very often in those smoky rooms, right? What we're in is the very clear-aired rooms of courts, suing for certain rights and you know, holding people to either statutory regulation or you know, constitutional regulation. For us, you know, there's a good reason we do that. It's because we feel that's more effective. That, as you say, the public interest doesn't have a huge lobbying budget, but justice and equity is the sort of thing that the is part and parcel of the court system. And it's in public, and it's something where it's sort of built to at least respond a little to the changing nature of business and society. So that's what we do. That's how we make that change. And you know, that's not something that everybody in the whole world should be doing. But it's one particular technique, and I think it complements that kind of political action, writing to your representative, and just being a technical expert, right? Because everybody listening to this podcast, I guarantee, is like seen as like some sort of technical guru to someone else in the world. Representing this stuff as part and parcel of what happens in the world, right? You know, it's very hard to explain to people that even people who understand the nature of free speech, why something like ACTA affects free speech. But everybody who sits there and explains that stuff to them has an effect. The example that always springs to mind when I talk about this stuff is a campaign that we did when I was based in the UK, where we had one of these very sort of visible complaint campaigns against a very wonky sort of bit of parliamentary procedure where there was a surveillance law, a kind of internet surveillance law, and in it it said, well, we will define who can use this kind of internet surveillance at a later time. And then they published a list, and the list included, you know, pretty much everyone who had any kind of government job, right? You know, the egg marketing board or like local councillors, city councillors, was able to use these powers. And so people who understood this, internet experty, geeky kind of people, went on the offensive, we publicized it, we lobbied and stuff like that. And eventually it was sort of abandoned and the list was restricted, but it was done so because I think it was the son of one of the prominent ministers was reading this stuff on the internet, and he on a game playing site, like basically he was a big Quake player or something like that. And, you know, he spoke to his dad about it. He went, hey, you know, I'm the internet expert in this family, and let me explain to you why this is the stupidest thing you're planning to do right now. And I think that's the kind of role that a lot of people who care about this stuff can play politically. Because your dad may not be the Minister of Surveillance in the United Kingdom or something like that, but you can at least, you are in a position of authority for a lot of people who don't understand this technology. And simply by sitting there saying, well, you trust me to remove the viruses on your Windows PC, at least trust me when I explain exactly why this trade agreement has overstepped its bounds. That can have an incredibly disproportionate effect.
And it's magnified too, I would say, by the rise of social networks. So it's not even just necessarily isolated family tech support guys like us, but birds of a feather flocking on Twitter and Eidetica and places, Facebook, places like that. I mean, you mentioned very early on C60 and C61, and Facebook played a very large role in the public action there. So you don't have to feel like you're alone. And I would also supplement that as well with that. Not only is it I know that's kind of the primary focus of what EFF does is the impact litigation, but you also run a great action center to help people in that process of writing their representatives and do a lot of education work as well. And beyond that, there are other organizations that I talk about in this podcast, and I'll link to some of them in the show notes for this episode. If you want to look at others like Knowledge Ecology International, Public Knowledge, and besides, that kind of fill out that full spectrum. So EFF has its role. There are other NGOs out there that do other kinds of action that all help out.
Yeah, I guess what we've done in this conversation is walk that strange line between sort of like complete pessimism that everything's doomed and complete optimism that you don't have to do anything because it'll all work out fine. And the truth is that, you know, it all could all go to hell and it could all be fine, but we're right on a sort of tightrope of that kind of thing. And I think the reason why I ended up getting involved in this sort of activism was I would do something on the internet and it would have some concrete effect. You know, you would see someone change their mind. Again, I can remember in the broadcast flag thing, someone forwarding me a comment from their senator who said, hey, you know, thank you for bringing this up. And it was clearly not the standard form letter. It was, I instructed my staffers to look into this, and yes, I can see why this would be a problem, and I will be saying something in the committee meeting about this. And really, it seems to me, at least, that's a very unusual position to be in about things that you care about. Is usually, you know, we all care about something like, you know, Haiti or some big disaster, but there doesn't seem to be much we can do. And I think that a lot of people who are technically savvy actually have an incredible amount of influence in this area, and part of that's proportionate to their mastery of new technology that lets them organize and so forth. Partly, to be frank, it's a function of the fact that almost nobody else cares about this stuff. So if you do care about it, then people listen to you and you're the only voice. But partly, I think it's proportionate just because everyone is learning about this stuff and coming to their decisions. So the more you can talk to them about it, the more allies you have. People have not come to conclusions about this. And they really will be influenced by what you say, whether they're senators or just your friends.
Danny, I really want to thank you. You've been very generous with your time. And hopefully our conversation has, at the very least, has informed my listeners who were concerned about, maybe didn't know as much about ACTA, and even more so, some of them to be motivated to actually act.
Great. Well, and you're absolutely right. If you go to action.eff.org, I believe we have an ACTA action on that site right now. Even if we don't, you know, you should all go ahead and do the research, think about it, smart people, and do something.
Absolutely. I'll include a link directly to that. I'll encourage people to also subscribe to the RSS feeds available at EFF.org, because I find those invaluable in terms of as things develop. Thanks again, Danny.
Thanks a lot.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for information on how you can help by making a donation, purchasing some swag, or downloading a promo in order to help spread the word. The simplest way you can help, of course, is just simply by telling a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call Listener Comment Line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night, will be a news program as usual. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 3.0 United States license. That means you're allowed to change and share this file as long as you share your changes, maintain attribution, and don't commercialize it without permission.